From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, when it comes to severe weather, how meteorologists distinguish between a forecast and a risk assessment.
We need to go from information that is, that's interesting, to, hey, we need you to be aware of something that could impact you in a negative way, and that's a risk.
Later, our agriculture series continues with aquaponics and the work being done in Wisconsin to train the next practitioners worldwide.
If you want to have yellow perch and you want to have it close at hand, supporting urban aquaponics and urban aquaculture is a new farming approach and doing it in an urban environment.
Radio Chipstone talks with one of the leaders of an influential Milwaukee-based children's clothing company.
And for Bastille Day, an interview with a Parisian band that made its Wisconsin debut earlier this summer at Eau Claire's. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before you went to bed on Wednesday night, you might have made sure the windows were closed and some of your sensitive electronics were unplugged. That's because until pretty late, the prevailing belief was that severe thunderstorms with high winds, frequent lightning, large hail, and heavy rain were due to roll in through the area.
But when you woke up on Thursday morning, the ground was dry and meteorologists were dissecting the storm that wasn't or wasn't here. Mike Westendorf is the operations manager for Innovative Weather at UW-Milwaukee, and he says Wednesday was emblematic of some of the challenges when it comes to predicting severe weather and sharing details with the public. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
It is great to be here.
We should start with first the point that you are not the National Weather Service. You do not issue the severe storm watches or warnings or advisories, but at the same time, you do have a relationship with them, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the National Weather Service, basically all of the weather information that we get as professionals, this is television, this is private sector, this is research community, all come from NCEP, the National Center for Environmental Prediction, of which the Weather Service is a part of that. It's one of the great things about this country that we have the kind of radar data that we have, the numerical model information, the research that's been done. This is been the foresight of people, you know, decades earlier who have really made the investment in this. So the National Weather Service, they like to call it the weather enterprise, of which they are a part of it. We are as well. And the Weather Service's job ultimately is pretty simple, to protect lives and property and to advance that ability through the research that they do. We then, in the private sector, television, other places, we then are partners in communicating that information. Now, we may differ in our opinions. Our audiences are different, so our styles of communication are going to be different. But when it really comes down to it, the National Weather Service is where the models get kicked off. And when it comes to the warnings, as you mentioned, you've got an entity called the Storm Prediction Center that really is the one looking at the nation and issues a general risk for the nation. And then the local offices are then a part of doing the warning pieces of things because they live locally or at least much closer to the action. Once they issue a warning or a watch for that matter, all of the private sector partners, if you will, start communicating that out to our audiences. Since we were built for better interaction with the public, National Weather Service was really better equipped for being the deep science, if you will, behind what we do.
Well, and so let me ask you a question about where those two things meet, because the Storm Prediction Center will issue a report on the risk for severe weather in a given place in a given day. And there's a scale of, I think, 1 to 5 being starting from just sort of generalized thunderstorm activity to high risk for severe thunderstorms. We'll see a report that the Prediction Center makes that says, say, southern Wisconsin has a slight risk for severe weather today. And at the same time, we'll see headlines that say severe thunderstorms are likely or are expected in southern Wisconsin. How does slight on one end go to likely on the other?
That's media and the need to grab attention, of which we're part of that a little bit. And, you know, we talk about this quite a bit here. I remember somebody accused us of being the no hype weather. And we thought we should like make that into a slogan because more people might actually listen to us. You know, the Storm Prediction Center and this product that they put out, like I said, it's a national categorical outlook. It's not a forecast. It's an outlook. It's trying to outline the areas that have the most likely chance for thunderstorms that will meet the Weather Service's criteria, by the way. It's 58 miles an hour or 1-inch size hail or larger or tornadoes. That's basically what they're looking for. So the SPC does a categorical outlook, and that's really for the professional community. However, the internet loves that stuff. Television loves that stuff. And they use that to kind of show, hey, we've got a slight risk of storms. The issue is that it needs to be interpreted and communicated on the local level. So when people are just looking for information to grab a headline, that headline becomes a slight risk to, hey, you really need to pay attention because it's likely. And again, we're like, well, what does that even mean? We're talking about Weather Service level warnings that we're actually talking about, not just general thunderstorms per se. So that's kind of how it gets translated that way a little bit. Just keep in mind, if you see an SPC product that really is meant for professionals, it needs interpretation.
Well, and this also seems to get to the idea of there being a difference between risk assessment and just a straight off weather forecast.
That, you know, you're touching on a big topic for me, so we can talk about this one as long as you want.
Well, in a nutshell, I mean, when it comes to someone who's listening to a weather forecast, what should they look at as a forecast, and how should they read into something in terms of risk assessment?
Yeah, so I'll do this the way that I do with our students. For a lot of them, they're coming in and they're learning how the atmosphere works and they're learning how to make a forecast. So you evaluate current conditions, you evaluate numerical models, and then you make your forecast for a variable, a high temperature, a wind direction, a cloud cover. That to me is forecasting, if you will. And so all of the general type of stuff, you know, we've got partly cloudy skies and a high temperature of 80 degrees with northwest winds at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Those are variables that we are good at forecasting. The issue is we need to go from information that is, that's interesting, to, hey, we need you to be aware of something that could impact you in a negative way, and that's a risk. So risk assessment, when you're talking about it in the future, demands that we communicate possibility and probability. If you only list the probable, it's kind of like a home run hitter, you know? Aaron Judge, I don't know what his strikeout rate, but, you know, the guy for the Yankees.
Right.
You know, he's hitting home runs and everybody's talking about it, but nobody talks about the strikeouts. I remember when we had Prince Fielder, you know, and he's socking home runs and everybody loves to talk about that, but at least 2-1, you know, he's striking out more than he is hitting home runs. And in our short attention span culture that we have we're packing so much information, even in media settings, or Twitter, you know, hey, you got 140 characters to tell about a forecast. I can only tell you about the probable outcome. And the problem with that is that when we're talking about the future, especially this time of year as a forecaster, there are a lot of different possibilities for our area. And sometimes there isn't a real probable outcome. I'll use Wednesday night as an example of that. All the heat and humidity, thunderstorms, and the models are showing widespread thunderstorm activity. We had been hit by very heavy rain earlier in the morning. But the system coming back in behind it was pretty weak, not very well organized, and so the storms didn't initiate. So what do I have to tell people? We've got a very unstable, well-sheared environment, which means severe storms are possible if they can get going. And that's a pretty big if this time of year. Therefore, I need people to understand that there's a chance for thunderstorms. If they develop, there will be a severe weather risk. But then I don't have time to tell you, we might not see anything. And so sometimes people can start thinking, well, you're just covering your butt. That's not actually what's happening. We're trying to help you understand both the possibility and the probability within a very small window of time. And that becomes the challenge.
Well, and at a certain point, it becomes incumbent on the listener or the viewer or the reader to do with this information as they think is appropriate for them.
You know, I always like to say for us, even, you know, when we're working with our partners, you know, we don't make a decision for We Energies or Lake Express or the Brewers. We don't make those decisions. We are here to give advice and counsel based on the risks that we have. I view it the same way for our listening audience. I'm here to help you make wise decisions when it comes to your safety. And to the best of our abilities, we're going to be doing that. And in order to do that well, you have to allow me to be able to talk about possibility and probability. But we are looking not only and considering you in your backyard, but 600,000 of you in your backyard, from basically the Illinois border all the way up to Fond du Lac. We're trying to tell it to you, tell a story to you personally, while asking you to think regionally.
Mike Westendorf is operations manager for UW-Milwaukee's Innovative Weather, and he's an occasional Lake Effect contributor. You can read the latest weather outlook at WUWM.com.
There were some who thought metaphorical storm clouds might linger over today's Bastille Day celebrations in France. A sharp political divide shaped the country's most recent national and regional elections. But in both cases, moderate candidates made significant gains. Lake Effect essayist Art Sear has some Bastille Day thoughts about the French Republic.
In parliamentary elections held in June, French voters continued the moderate trend which was apparent in the presidential election in May. In that earlier election, Emmanuel Macron was elected chief executive of the nation by a substantial margin. He decisively defeated radical nationalist Marine Le Pen. An important factor has been widespread anxiety regarding Le Pen and her party, fueled in part by the long, controversial political career of her outspoken father, Jean-Marie Le Pen. Before the actual voting, there was some indication she might win the presidency. Macron's moderate movement, La République En Marche, has won a majority of seats. This gives the new president a solid political foundation. In total, the magnetic young leader of France is well positioned to exercise strong leadership within Europe and well beyond. That is important and basically positive not only for France, but also the nation's allies, including Britain and the United States. Perhaps reflecting the anxiety resulting from continuing murderous terrorist attacks, a great deal of media commentary about the French government and leadership has been downbeat and downright skeptical. Some early polls indicated the LRM might secure a much more substantial majority. Voter turnout was low, giving some commentators an opening to emphasize apathy and indifference. That skepticism masks the reality that the French have voted strongly for moderation, which is the course most likely to result in effective and workable policies. Historically, France suffered after World War II from chronically unstable governments and weak institutions. The rise of Jean-Marie and now Marine Le Pen has raised the specter of that past. The pragmatic realism of today's French voters and leaders includes the European Union. France was one of the six founding members of the original European Economic Community, established in 1957. However, France's President Charles de Gaulle was fundamentally opposed to a centralized organization. More recently, voters in France in 2005 rejected a highly ambitious plan to have a constitution for the European Union. Civil servants in Brussels, removed from practical politics and voters, erroneously calculated that they could greatly increase and centralize power. Diplomats are relatively removed from public opinion. Over time, their constant round of negotiations and receptions can generate a false sense of progress. Cold water from French voters ended such illusions concerning the proposed European Constitution. The great length and complexity of the document in hindsight implies that extensive prose was being used to avoid hard political realities. Economic integration, plus a rapidly expanding body of European law, has encouraged the belief that commercial coordination is the same as political unification. Yet that is a serious miscalculation. As in other parts of the world, Europeans have been unwilling to surrender control over the basic element of sovereignty, military forces. President Macron became a top civil servant earlier in his career and has made the unusual leap from that world to the very different one of elected politics, with tremendous success. He was also an effective Rothschild investment banker. He emphasizes pro-business, market-oriented economic reforms, a major departure. France became a highly centralized state early, with emphasis on bureaucracy and control. Not even the bloody French Revolution in the 18th century changed this tradition. Over the near term, the new moderate reformist government of France can provide economic and political realism. Britain is being encouraged to reconsider the hard line regarding the European Union. Relations with Germany remain key.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He is a regular Lake Effect contributor on foreign policy.
A short break now, and when we return, our full plate series on Wisconsin agriculture continues with two forces behind the aquaponics movement in this part of the state. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences has established itself in recent years as a leading center for research into the Great Lakes ecosystem. At the same time, just across town is one of the country's leading organizations in the field of urban agriculture, growing power.
So it probably makes sense that the two institutions have a history of collaboration in a variety of arenas. Case in point is their work involving aquaponics, the field of cultivating both plants and fish in a controlled environment. They collaborate on a series of workshops in the winter and spring for people interested in getting into the field commercially. But their research and practice is a year-round enterprise.
Will Allen is a farmer, founder, and CEO of Growing Power. Fred Binkowski is a senior scientist at the UWM School of Freshwater Sciences, and they joined us in the studio earlier this year. Welcome to Lake Effect.
We're happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So we're having this conversation, and we are 9 blocks from this enormous body of fresh water, Lake Michigan. And there are probably people who are listening to this interview thinking, why do we need a different way of producing fish than fish naturally reproducing in this enormous body of water?
Well, I think Fred can answer that from a scientific standpoint of what's happening in the Great Lakes and what has happened in the Great Lakes in terms of die-off of certain species or reduction in certain species and the way the ecology of the lake and so forth. But, we can't just say, well, we can't eat those fish out in the Great Lakes or because their species are at a point where we can't fish for them anymore. We have to figure out a way of doing this. And I think these indoor facilities are important because you have less mercury in the fish and so forth. You have a cleaner product, and you're able to test the product and keep it under control. So I think that's important to me, that we know what we're giving our customer.
Well, if the people out there say we have this large body of water and we have these multitude of fishes out there, well, for starters, if they're interested in yellow perch, the commercial fishery for yellow perch in Lake Michigan has been shut down since 1996. So there's no product coming by way of commercial fishing, at least out of Lake Michigan. There's a very limited amount of fish being taken out of Green Bay. So the major commercial fishery for yellow perch in the Great Lakes region to supply the Friday night fish fries and just to supply the seafood industry is coming primarily from Lake Erie, which would be both U.S. and Canadian waters. So if you want to have yellow perch and you want to have it close at hand, supporting urban aquaponics and urban aquaculture is a new farming approach and doing it in an urban environment. Doing urban aquaculture and urban aquaponics, you're putting the product at the center of consumer demand. You're reducing the carbon footprint significantly because of that. You don't have to be trucking stuff, you know, like our tomato that we eat in the wintertime travels about 2,000 miles before it gets to our kitchen counter. So aquaponics is a growing idea. It's a growing, people are interested in it. And it can be done on both a large scale, large commercial scale, but it can also be done on a home scale too, backyard type farming.
Can you talk about where UWM was coming from when it started collaborating with Growing Power?
Well, give you a little bit of history related to that question is back in the day, and by that I mean like starting in the 70s, aquaponics was known as hydroponics, and a lot of farming was done, but it was using water only, and the manure or the fertilizer just came by way of chemicals that were added to the system. And then gradually hydroponics started evolving into aquaponics, where people started thinking of doing this more as an integrated approach. And that's kind of where we came into the picture because of the fact that we were doing a lot of aquaculture with finfish and to some extent with shellfish. And yellow perch is the target species, especially here in the Great Lakes region. The Great Lakes cities have a long tradition and history with yellow perch associated with the Friday night fish fries. Big thing during the Lent season, yellow perch becomes like the icon of the Friday night fish fries. And with that, because of all of the science and technology work that we were doing at the School of Freshwater Sciences on yellow perch, we felt it was a good fit for aquaponics, and partnering up with Growing Power and Will, we thought that we would try to use that information to expand what he was doing with tilapia and move it into yellow perch. And there's other freshwater fish that would be probably ideally suited for it too, like hybrid bluegills and maybe hybrid walleyes, and walleyes even would be a good one.
Well, so what are the kinds of things that you are still learning about aquaponics that you're putting into practice?
Well, I think for us, it's learning more about different types of filter systems that creating a hybrid system versus the original system that I built over 20 years ago, which was simply a system to recirculate the water and using plants as a filtration, as a remediation piece to that system. But now we use sand filters and other different types of filters, systems that they use at UW-Milwaukee, systems that Fred introduced us to. But I think the piece that we're trying to do, because we look at our facility at Growing Power as a big laboratory. I mean, we're not going to be able to grow as many fish as needed in the area or the region or whatever. But to be able to train people that are interested, because aquaponics and aquaculture as a whole is very, a lot of people are very interested in getting into that industry. So this allows us to train folks to a certain degree, inspire them to go out and get started on smaller systems and really learn how to do this, because this is much different than just growing some plants. Fish, you really have to know what you're doing, because, you know, if something goes south, you know, you got to know how to get your fish back in line and save as many as you can in a lot of cases. So we've learned a lot. But part of what we're trying to do as an organization is really to grow some jobs, too, through this, and grow the health of the people in our city. As you know, Milwaukee is one of those cities where a lot of people don't have access to really good food. So that's all part of our history. We're in our 25th year now at Growing Power. So that's all been a part of our history.
Well, and, you know, without necessarily getting political, I'm curious, given how long you've been in this business, this life, if you will, the previous White House, growing fresh foods and local foods was a real priority, especially for the former First Lady Michelle Obama.
Right.
You know, obviously, it does not seem like this is a priority for the current White House, but I'm curious how much difference, as someone who's involved in this, how much difference do you see influence from the top making in the overall interest in things like aquaponics and local foods?
Right. Well, I think it's tremendous influence, especially from the First Lady Michelle Obama. It's estimated that over 10 million people started growing food when she put that small garden on the White House lawn. I was fortunate to be able to work with her over the course of their stay in at the White House. So when we were able to do some really important things and influence people and get people inspired to go out and just start something. Because the hardest thing to do is for people to do is get something started. People will go to trainings or read books and forever and ever, but to get them started on something is something that's really important. And I think she's been very instrumental in helping to do that. So I'd like to give her a lot of credit. This new administration, it's too early to tell whether they'll keep the garden at the White House. It would be a real tragedy if they stopped doing that. The National Park Service is the one that actually does the physical work on the garden, so maybe it'll continue. I hope so, but you never know. Because as we listen to the you know, the primaries and so forth. Nobody ever talked about the food system, which is the most important thing in our lives is our food. So we'll have to see, you know, what's going to happen.
I imagine, not to put words in your mouth, there's a certain amount of work that needs to be done to keep this idea in front of people.
Absolutely. And that's what we have to do, is to be able to do things, get the word out of what's going on. You know, like today, this great opportunity that you're giving us to talk about what we're doing is a way of educating folks and letting them know what's going on and what we've been doing for all these years. Because it takes a long time. These things don't happen overnight, you know. And I always tell people we're at the infancy stages of what we're doing.
So you do a series of workshops with would-be aquaponics practitioners in the first half of the year. Talk about where they fit into this dynamic.
Yeah, we spend 2 days actually building a starter system that's about 700-gallon system. And everybody participates. And as I travel the country, I find these systems all over the country and all over the world now. So,
I'm curious. I wonder if you see a lot of people who might go into this thinking that this would be, for lack of a better word, a hobby, and don't really realize how much effort and tending to it they need to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're doing sustainable agriculture, which we're doing, there's a lot of day-to-day work. You have to put in the time, and you got to be committed. And the people that aren't committed get out of it very quickly because they realize that they can't. Keeping these fish alive is something that you have to be on top of all the time. So,
this is not like having a goldfish tank in your...
No,
no. And I usually use the analogy that this is not like going to the hardware store in the spring of the year and buying a package of radish seeds and bringing them home and planting it, and 25 days later you'll have radishes. That's just not the case at all. There's a lot of effort that has to go into this, and you have to be very diligent and very responsible about doing the things that you have to do, and it's a continuously repeating routine. And for some people, that can get boring, and then they just kind of start taking shortcuts, and that will lead to problems, and eventually they'll have a lot of difficulty with their system, and some either with the plants and vegetables or with the fish. The fish are probably the most risky and sensitive part of this whole thing. As Will often says to me, he says, "See that plant over there in a corner? It's wilting. But if I go water it tomorrow, it's going to be well."
Yeah.
With a fish, if it's on its side floating around, there's not much that you can do for it. So you have to really be on top of it with regards to the finfish and shellfish biology part.
A lot of effort, but a lot of payoff potentially.
Big payoff, yeah. Personal and probably to some extent too financial.
Yeah.
Fred Binkowski, Will Allen, thanks to both of you for sharing this story, and best of luck in your work.
Thank you very much for
the opportunity.
Yeah.
Former pro basketball player and MacArthur Genius Grant winner Will Allen is the founder and CEO of Growing Power. Fred Binkowski is a senior scientist at the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. You can learn more about their aquaponics work at WUWM.com.
Radio Chipstone speaks with the vice president of a high-end Milwaukee-based children's clothing manufacturer when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Whether we're eating camembert on Bastille Day or mozzarella on a pizza, there is no question Wisconsinites love our cheese. But increasingly, those with a taste for European cheeses can stay in the Wisconsin section of the dairy case.
Earlier this year, we checked in with our cheese contributor, Jeanette Hurt, who had recently returned from a scouting trip up north where she found some pretty remarkable people carrying on European cheese traditions.
Well, I went all the way up north, way up there to Turtle Lake, and I went to visit Schumann Cheese's creamery operation, and I also visited the dairy side as well. We went to the farm, North Swiss Farms, and it was a really interesting experience. I've been to dozens upon dozens upon dozens of creameries here in Wisconsin, but I've never gone quite that far north and west, I would say. It's way
it's
up
kind of
there.
Above the dairy belt, really.
It is, but like many places in Wisconsin, there are still lots of cows.
Well, and so why is the Schumann Cheese Company's plant there such a big deal?
What is interesting is their partnership. Schumann Cheese is actually started out as an Italian cheese importing company in New Jersey. It's now fourth generation, and they are the largest importer of hard Italian cheeses. Some years ago, about 10 years ago, they purchased the plant in Turtle Lake. And this is a plant that was making Italian-style cheeses. Again, very nice fit. They mostly make aged cheeses like Parmesan, like Asiago, Romano. They also, because when you're making things like Parmesan, you can use the whey to make other things that, like lighter cheeses. They make mascarpone and they make some other products. What is interesting is their head cheesemaker is a French man, and he travels around to their other cheese plants. His name is Christophe Megavon.
And apparently there's no problem with a French cheesemaker being in charge of making Italian-style cheeses.
Nope. They all love cheese. They figure the passion is there whether you're in Italy, France, or Wisconsin. And Christophe was visiting this plant over time, and they wanted to expand their operations to include some other cheeses. And one of the things they decided that would be natural, they make hard Italian cheeses, so some hard French Alpine-style cheeses. So instead of just Christophe teaching the cheesemakers, and he has a special – he started his career actually in the French Alps, so he has a strong background there. But he went back for some education in France, and he met this instructor, Julien Rouillade, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's taught for the last 20 years at the French Ministry of Agriculture's École Nationale d'Industrie Laitière. So he's a French cheesemaker instructor, and he, again, specializes in the French Alpine style of cheeses. They are going to be releasing these cheeses this May, and there are three cheeses, and the two that I'm most interested in, one is called Valis. It's similar to a raclette. It's a softer Alpine cheese, mm-hmm. but it's the kind that you melt in a raclette maker and scrape over potatoes and bread and things like that. And then there's Montis, which is an Appenzeller-style cheese. Now, what I find most exciting about that now is you can actually make a Swiss fondue using just Wisconsin cheeses, because a good Swiss fondue, as I was taught, has Gruyere. So instead, you can go and get Emmy Roth's Private Reserve. Then you can go and get Bruce Workman's at Edelweiss Town Hall Creamery, his Emmentaler cheese. And now you can go get Schumann Cheese's Montis. So you can make a Swiss-style fondue just using Wisconsin cheese. Very exciting.
I'm going to raise my hand here with a question, and this comes from someone who – I'm not a cheesemaker. I'm not a cheese expert. I enjoy cheeses. When we talk about Alpine-style cheeses, does the elevation not matter? The thing that jumps out at me is we do not have the Alps in Wisconsin.
No, we don't, but we have lots of cows. We have the right temperatures for it, which is, again, 40 to 50 degrees. That's where cows are usually their happiest. And we have a dairy and cheese culture. And that is a pun, but it also is very...
That's a good pun, too.
It's the truth. So it's not in the Alps. It's not the exact same thing, but you can use similar recipes. And then, as both Christophe and Julien said, they want the American cheesemakers at Schumann, at the Lake Country Dairy, to really put their own stamp. It's not going to be...
The idea is not they're not imitating an Alp cheese here.
They're using similar methods. They're using similar cultures. But ultimately, the milk and the environment is different. So it's not going to be exact, But that's the other thing. With these cheeses like Appenzeller, a lot of these kind of cheeses are name protected. As they wanted to emphasize, these are similar to but not exact imitations or replicas. That said, I would think they're really good substitutions if you're looking for Swiss cheese or Swiss-styled cheese made locally.
Food writer Jeanette Hurt is the author of a number of books, including Drink Like a Woman and The Cheeses of Wisconsin, a culinary travel guide. She is also our Lake Effect cheese contributor.
Usually when we go to museums, we're looking at objects that are rare or historic. Their value comes from how they helped create the narrative of the universal we.
But there's an exhibit at the Museum of Wisconsin Art that is precious for reasons that are personal. Terry Shapiro-Larson is VP and head of the design unit at Florence Eisman, a Milwaukee children's apparel company that's been keeping infants and toddlers in style since 1945. When President and Michelle Obama sent garments to the children of dignitaries, friends, and families, it was the cross-stitching of Larson that personalized the gift.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Larson and contributor Jennifer Fields discuss the Eisman vision and the driving force behind her designs.
Well, I think her goal was to make the child look like a child and not like a miniature adult. So there's a lot of sense of humor in the clothes. There's a lot of prettiness in the clothes. It had to be comfortable. The colors had to be clear. Nothing muted, and it had to look good on different skin types, but it was to make the child look like a child and enjoy their childhood.
When you're designing clothing for children, is it the thing where you have an outline and within that outline you find freedom? Do you ever feel constricted by this idea that it has to look like an Eisman?
Oh, absolutely. It's like being typecast as an actor. They have an idea of who you are and what you are, and if you go beyond that, it's a very difficult thing to sell. But you have to keep expanding and you have to keep pushing that or you get stale. So it has to look new, it has to look fresh, but it still has to be within the confines of who you are and what you're known for. The whole process for doing the designs, we have a die made for each of those shapes, and it's this little metal cutout that's made in the shape of the piece that needs to be cut out, and we have a big machine. The fabric that it's cut out is stacked up. This die is put on top of this machine, and the machine stamps it out. So the way that the dies are made have to be fairly simple shapes, and so it leads to these very graphic-looking appliques. And so when I'm designing these things, it has to be a shape that has the ability to be made into a die, and it usually ends up being this very simple, kind of whimsical, geometric shape.
But in that simplicity is that timelessness.
The simplicity, the minimalism, it's clean, it's unfussy. Mrs. Eisman did not like the fussiness of clothes at the time, and so this was her idea of how children should look.
How long have you been working for the Eisman Company?
45 years.
So in that 45 years, have you seen a difference in demand from what parents are looking for in children's clothing?
Oh, absolutely. America has gotten a lot more casual, so we're really focusing more on knits, on more casual clothes. We don't do as many velvet dresses. We don't do as many very formal things anymore because we've just gotten a lot more casual. Even what I'm wearing right now, I would not have worn this to work 20 years ago. But the mothers still want that very special dress for that very special occasion. So you have to balance it and make sure that you have plenty of those things too.
Children 40 years ago, 45 years ago, I don't want to say behave differently, but they had different needs than a child may have now.
I think that the trend has changed. Throughout this exhibit, you'll see that some of these dresses are made for older children. We can't sell these to older children anymore. We have our own particular 7 to 14 line of dresses that are a little older looking, they're a little trendier looking, but they're still very classical and they're still very tasteful. But this younger look of the applique can no longer go beyond a size 6X.
So looking at, there's a catalog over here, mm-hmm. and there are children in these clothes mm-hmm. in that catalog. Talk to me about having your work not only be part of a gallery installation, but now it's part of a catalog that goes with an installation.
I think it's fabulous. The catalog is absolutely beautiful, and to see contemporary children in some of these clothes from 30 years ago is really phenomenal. But they're children's clothes. They should be worn. They should be touched. They should last. They should be able to be worn now.
So the thought that, Terry, you could walk over there, take that jumper off the wall and hand it to a child and put it on.
Sure, absolutely. Isn't that fun? There's nothing better than to see children in the clothes that you've designed and that are Florence Eisman. It's great. I love it.
As you stand here in an art gallery, looking at children's clothing that you've designed, talk to me about making that connection with what you do. As a clothing designer, becoming art.
I came in here last Thursday to get a little preview of that, and I had no idea that it was going to be this spectacular. And I walked in, and I honestly started crying, because it's your whole life. Your whole life is here, and it takes you through different periods of your life when I designed this, and different periods when I was into this look, and the things that were happening to me personally as I'm going through my life at Florence Eisman. So it's very emotional.
And I have to tell you, what's really funny about this, Terry, is that the women who were in this gallery were doing the same thing.
Oh, it's a very emotional experience. It really builds memories. It's just very emotional. And we have a very loyal following of families who have passed this down from generation to generation, and they still love the clothes.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
Saturday afternoon, the Museum of Wisconsin Art will present The Rise of a Design Legend, an artist talk about the Eisman exhibit. There is more information at WUWM.com.
As we noted earlier on the show, today is Bastille Day. We'll meet a couple of the members of a rock band based in Paris when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. As the summer festival season enters into full swing, it's a good time to reflect on what actually brings acts to Wisconsin. While we draw plenty of internationally touring acts to the state year-round, the growing number of music festivals, from Summerfest to Appleton's Mile of Music to Twin Lakes Country Thunder, millions of people will take in an outdoor concert in Wisconsin this year.
While the crowd numbers are smaller, the festival called Eau Claire's brought some well-known acts to western Wisconsin last month, and it brought some bands on the rise as well, including one that made the trip to Eau Claire all the way from Paris.
Lake Effect contributor Eden Herbert caught up with the members of This Is the Kit, including founder and lead vocalist Kate Stables and keyboard player Rosie Plain, along with Jamie Whitby Coles on drums. Stables talked about the international nature of the band.
I live in Paris. But me and Rosie, thumb in your face, were born in Winchester. Okay. But then we all used to live in Bristol, which is where we met Jamie. So we're also a band from Bristol and Winchester, as well as being a band from Paris. And we're here because there are friends of ours that sort of organised the festival, and we've been sort of, it feels like kind of an extension of a residency stroke festival we took part in last autumn in Berlin at Mitchell Berger. And so Justin from Bon Iver was there, and the Desna brothers were organising it, and that was a nice time of collaboration and just sort of starting projects together. And this seems like a very similar sort of spirit and philosophy, even though this is the third year now, isn't it, though? So it was more like maybe the Mitchell Berger project was an offshoot of this sort of nice idea of people coming and playing music together.
And you mentioned the Dessner brothers. You guys have actually done a project with Aaron Dessner, right?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I've known him for a few years through mutual friends, and then he came to a show we did in London a few years ago and suggested we do some work together, and so we did. He produced our last album, and that was really great.
I've always been curious about the nature between artists when they come to music festivals, because it's kind of weird. Not everybody that comes to a festival is here to see you guys. They're here for other people sometimes. I just want to know, like, what are the thoughts and feelings that go through an artist's head when they come to a festival? Do you guys look at the lineup and say, these are other artists I want to talk to? Or what goes through the mindset in deciding to come and perform at a festival?
I guess it depends. I probably can't speak for every artist in the world ever that's been to a festival. But for me personally, yeah, I see what bands I want to see, and it's nice to meet people and say hello and have a chat. If there's other people that are up for that, you know, some people like to stay kind of private, but there's a lot of nice people hanging around backstage that are up for encounters, so that's nice.
It's nice also to often, like, because I guess we sort of tour quite a lot and in the UK, and like it's nice to sort of cross paths again with bands that we know, or and maybe sometimes with a bit more hanging out time.
Yeah, that's it. When you're on tour, you'll meet other bands and cross paths, but it'll be very speedy. It'll just be one night or something. Whereas here, you can actually catch up and have proper conversations.
Is there any pressure to stand out from the crowd when you're on a bill with a couple dozen acts?
Probably in theory there is, but all we can do is be ourselves and do what we do. And I kind of assume that that's why we were asked to play, is because they're up for us being ourselves. So that is what I currently think. But yeah, you want to do a good show. That's obviously what we always want to try and achieve.
And as we're talking, you guys are just a couple hours from performing with the John Prine tribute. Who is John Prine to you, and what does it mean to be performing in this amazing act that Bon Iver put together?
Well, for me, John Prine is like one of the artists that my parents listened to when I was growing up, and my dad's a big fan. So I know most of the John Prine songs I know are from him singing them rather than the original recordings or whatever. And there's the song that I'm singing is one that I learned from the Nancy Griffiths album, Other Voices, Other Rooms, where she sings one of his songs. And it's just the family soundtrack, you know, car journeys, holidays, things like that.
When you guys were forming this band a little bit over 10 years ago, was there a goal you had in mind as artists, and has that changed over time?
Not for me.
Okay.
It's kind of just been a gradual, lovely journey. And it feels like it's changing all the time, but also not changing all the time.
We just enjoy playing music together. I guess if to be honest, it's my songs that we play. Like, Rosie also has her own band where her songs get played, and Jamie also has his own band where his songs get played. But in This Is The Kit, it's my songs, and so it's just nice to play together.
Right, I wanted to ask you, because you guys are kind of weird, right, where you're kind of considered the one true constant member of the band. You kind of have a bunch of different people flowing in and out, and I just wanted to know about the decision that went into being called This Is The Kit rather than being a solo act.
I think it's because I didn't want to be a solo act, and I wanted to be able to do a variety of different things, not necessarily songs, maybe just sort of noises, maybe instrumental stuff, maybe dancing, you know. I didn't want it to be singer-songwriter, this is my name. I wanted to have a few more options.
And as different people come in and out, do you find that some of your songs change, the sound that you're into kind of changes?
Yeah, and for me that's the whole point, really, to play with different people and then have different music grow out of that.
And what I think is really unique about you guys is you often go back and to past songs and rework them, sometimes with electric vibes, sometimes different lead vocals. What goes into, or what is the value to you in doing that?
Well, it makes it more interesting for us to change things, because if you play it the same for 10 years, it's less interesting than if you change it every couple of years.
And yeah, like, and songs sort of come and go and sort of become sort of more and less relevant. Sometimes sort of old songs just suddenly sort of a new song again or something, or sort of taken on a different thing. It's not like, it's nice to sort of lose some immediate familiarity with them, and then they can sort of be a different thing again or something like this.
Sort of the convection currents of old and new material, it's just they just things fall off the set list shelf and then you find them in a cupboard later and put them back on the set list, but change them a bit.
Do you guys have a specific title that you would give your sound?
Oh,
do you want my one?
I want your one, Rosie. Can I steal it?
You can have it. You can have it.
You say it.
Thrift Shop Pop.
Thrift Shop Pop. That's awesome. I can't say it as well as you guys because the accents are much better when you say it.
Thrift Shop Pop.
That's good.
Mary Poppins.
Can you explain that just a little bit for our listeners?
Someone actually said that's how they describe, like, I have a project and we were playing at South by Southwest last year. Me and Jamie plays the drums in my band and there was a little tweet afterwards. Someone said Thrift Shop Pop, and it's perfect. It's brilliant. We've all, yeah.
We like charity shops and jumble sales.
And all our instruments have a collective value of £10.
Yeah, exactly. All our instruments are just bought at thrift shops or found in bins. So,
do you guys kind of make up stories for the instruments when you get them?
No. They have their own stories.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you guys so much for speaking with us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Great questions as well.
Oh, well, thank you guys.
10 out of 10. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you.
Kate Stables is the founder and lead vocalist, and Rosie Plain is the keyboard player for the Paris-based band This Is The Kit. They spoke with Lake Effect contributor Eden Herbert on site at the Eau Claire's Music Festival last month.
They talked near the stage where Tweety was playing. We heard plenty of them in the background. Now here is some This Is The Kit in the foreground to take us out, a song called Bulletproof.
Swim, the tide is coming in. We spent too long watching. Bullet holes rushing in. No use bailing. Bulletproof. They never loved you.
And that's the Friday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayon Silver, and our interns, Eden Herbert and Katie Kokel.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz, Aisha Turner, and Rachel Morello, plus web support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from Jason Reeve and John Stralecki. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.